Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WBEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. I'm your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Yu, who is the president and executive director of the Public Assets Institute. And yay, we're finally getting a chance to talk about the 2023 State of Working Vermont report, which thank you, Stephanie, giving me an excuse to nerd out. Always appreciated. And thank you for joining us today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Always happy to talk about this report.
One of my first questions for you, because I know you have worked on several of these reports now. What was the big differences for you for 2023 compared to the years that came before it, especially given that we're kind of out of the pandemic, but kind of not? I'm still kind of saying it that way.
I know. I feel like we've been hedging a lot on whether we're calling it over or not over, considering that I think it went through my house just a couple weeks ago.
But this
is the big difference. I feel like for us, we really were thinking about this as a back to baseline report, right? How much of the ups and downs of the pandemic are now either over or they're sort of a new normal? You know, what do we want? How do we think about it that way? Because I think for the last couple of years, we've really been saying, yeah, like things are all over the place and we don't know what's going to stick and what's not going to stick. And so I think finally we do feel like we did this sort of pre-pandemic and comparison to 2023. And it really is sort of starting to show up. Like, what do we see as long-term trends versus what was just temporary disruption?
And for you, what stands out on that as far as what was temporary versus what seems long-term?
So I think a couple of things. So this is State of Working Vermont. So we're focused a lot on working Vermonters, but we're also kind of using a broad definition of work. You know, it's paid, it's unpaid. How are people experiencing the economy? So, you know, I think one of the reasons we do this report is because oftentimes the perspective, as you say, like the perspective is sort of from a official economic perspective of, you know, sort of a formal economics, like what are the formal indicators? And we really always want to look at how Vermonters are doing, right? So what does this tell us about, we use the economic indicators, but then what does it also tell us about what Vermonters are actually experiencing in sort of their day-to-day and how has that changed? What's the impact on household budgets? What's going on there? But we do look at a lot of the labor market pieces. And I think the top line sort of labor market story is that we're essentially back, right? When we released the report, we've had another month or two of data since then, and we're pretty much back on both employment and jobs, back to pre-pandemic levels, you know, roughly, right? It's not always the same industries and it's not always distributed. But what's amazing about that is that, you know, since that sort of really big crash during the lockdown in March, April 2020, it's really been coming back pretty steadily, which I don't know if we really knew what to expect at that point, right? Like, I just don't think we knew how long businesses would stay closed, how much we'd have to stay locked down, and then what would happen from there. So that's one piece. Another piece that we really wanted to look at was the effects of the COVID aid, right? So there was COVID aid. There's a lot of federal COVID aid that went to states. Some of it was going towards public services. Some of it was going right to individuals' pockets, right? There were those stimulus payments. There was the expanded child tax credit. There were also increased unemployment benefits for people who were out of work for whatever period of time. And then there was money that also went to businesses too. And so we wanted to really kind of look at what those effects were. And I think what we really take away from all this is that many of the problems that COVID was attempting to, that the COVID aid was trying to help with, existed before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Now that the aid is gone, we run the risk of those problems sort of taking hold again, right? We saw a big dip in poverty largely because of the expanded child tax credit. We can say that's definitely true in Vermont, but it was absolutely true across the country too, right? It wasn't unique to Vermont. And we expect that to pop back up. It is starting to pop back up in the absence of that aid. So, you know, some of these problems were ongoing. I think a lot of these housing conversations that you're hearing at the state level right now is another indication of something that we knew it was a problem before. It probably got worse during the pandemic and since. And the question is, does it change our strategy about how we approach the problem?
Yes. I think that's an intriguing question. How does it change our strategy? And looking at the data and looking at some of the policy going through the legislature right now. Public Assets Institute folks may remember we did an interview with Annika Heilweil, December, I believe it was, where we talked about funding Vermont's future and changing the tax code to make it more progressive at the top. And I know Public Assets has been working hard on that, but are you seeing other ways the conversation may be changing at the state level, but also maybe stuck in places where it's not helpful?
So a couple of things. I think that people did appreciate how clear it was, how much the temporary policies during the pandemic really helped people, right? A lot of people were taking care of their basic needs. There was more food aid. There was, you know, these, like I say, these increased sort of cash benefits, the child tax credit, the unemployment benefits, all of these things were contributing to this decrease in poverty, really contributing to people being able to make ends meet in a better way. So I think that there was a lot of momentum coming into just over the last, you know, the last legislative session and this, that we really wanted to continue to meet those needs. It's why Vermont, I think, enacted their own state child tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, wasn't going to be quite as big as the federal tax credit, but it was definitely a huge step in helping families. And then I think what we saw is, you know, this sort of housing challenge really sort of explode last summer as the federal aid was running out, and it was clear that there wasn't a plan,
mm-hmm.
right, to continue to house people, or, you know, to provide alternatives to permanent housing, or, you know, other options. And I think that conversation obviously is still a big part of the conversation happening this session. And so I think there was a lot of interest in a recognition that we want a progressive tax code, a commitment to a progressive tax code. And part of the reason that our report actually came out late this year, and part of the reason that it came out late this year, was because we were waiting on some data from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, because every few years they put out a report called Who Pays, right? And it really looks at the share of people's incomes that they pay in taxes across the different income levels. So for the, you know, the lowest 20%, what share are they paying? The top 1%, what share of their income are they paying in taxes? And it's a report that we rely on quite a bit. And they only do it every few years. And I think partly because of the pandemic, it was a little longer of a wait than in the past, because the data for 2020 was just so unreliable, I guess. So the last time they did it was 2018. You know, so it sort of, again, it kind of gives you that pre-pandemic, post-pandemic kind of comparison. And what they showed, so Vermont, I think, should be proud in the sense that we're one of the few states that doesn't make income inequality worse, right? A lot of state tax codes actually make it worse, right? So, but Vermont's doesn't. However, we still see that Vermont's tax code is pretty regressive at the top end, right? That the top 1%, the top 5% are paying a smaller share than a lot of people in the middle class in terms of taxes. So that was part of why we waited, and part of what we wanted to really kind of look at. And I think it also showed some of the positive effects of the efforts, like the child tax credit, really sort of bringing down the share that people, that folks are paying on the low income end. You know, Vermont stacks up pretty well in terms of at the low income end, that people at the low income end pay a lower share of their income in taxes in Vermont than in all the other New England states, definitely lower than the US average. Like, that's pretty good. And it's true in the middle class too, right? Vermont, the middle class Vermonters tend to pay a slightly lower share than a lot of the middle class in other states. So it's really at that high end where we start to be regressive. We have a progressive income tax. We have income sensitivity in school taxes. So I think that information was really critical, and we really wanted to look at sort of how Vermont stacked up. And that's part of why we wanted to wait and include it in this report.
If you don't mind, I'd love if we would dig into that a little bit and just remind people about why it matters that we have a more progressive revenue streams. I know one thing that stood out for me today is I was listening to Brave Little State, and they actually, the episode I caught was they were rebroadcasting an episode from a fellow public radio station. I'm forgetting its name, but the podcast is If All Else Fails. And it's about the rise of extremism in Upper New York State. And one thing they said in the the interview was how income inequality in a lot of rural communities is one of the things that's driving some of the more extreme groups to form. And that just is something I'm sitting with right now, is, something I never thought income inequality could do, but I get the point. And one thing we've had to be careful with in Vermont is, while you said our tax structure doesn't make income inequality worse, but it doesn't mean we don't have it, and it doesn't mean it hasn't been growing. So all that said, with all that's going on in Olga's brain right now, I would love to hear your take on why it's important we have a progressive revenue stream for the state. And not only that, but why we need more revenue.
Absolutely. So I think you're identifying two important points, I think. One, which is sort of the progressivity of the system, of the revenue system, and then the adequacy of the revenue system, right? So we want the, I always talk about, speaking of sort of nerding out, I always sort of talk about that the slope of the line and then the location of the line, right? Like, we know we want it to be more progressive, and it probably needs to go up because we know there's public investments that we're neglecting to do right now, things like housing, and we need to respond to climate change. And so there's definitely more demand for more public investment. So I think to answer the original question, which is why do we need a progressive tax system? I think you're identifying, I think there's two pieces, right? One, I think there's broad agreement across sort of policymakers, legislatures in Vermont and around the country that income is really the best measure of somebody's ability to pay taxes, right? And so a progressive system based on income makes sense. I think, to your point, that underlying income inequality also tells you where the money is going, right? So the fact that income inequality, and you're right, income inequality is increasing in Vermont. Just because our tax code doesn't make it worse than what it would be if we had a different tax code, it can still be growing on its own, right? Like, the income inequality, and I say on its own, which, although that's not true, right? It's a policy choice to have this much income inequality. So I think there's broad agreement that we want a progressive tax system. We already have this progressive income tax. We do have, one of the things that also is unique about Vermont's property tax system is because we have income sensitivity and school taxes. In most states, the property tax is a regressive tax, meaning that the lowest income people are paying the biggest share, like the sales tax. We know that the sales tax is regressive because everybody needs a certain amount of stuff. Like, the bite of your income that stuff takes is obviously much bigger at the lower end, right? So we know the sales tax is regressive. Income taxes can be any of the above, but many states have a flat income tax, and Vermont has a progressive income tax. So, which mirrors the federal progressive tax. The property tax is the weird one, where in most states it is regressive, but because we have income sensitivity, it's relatively progressive through kind of the middle class, and then becomes regressive on the higher end, where people are still paying based on property value instead of based on income. So there's sort of a lot of moving parts, I think, in there. But I do think this issue of increase, and I think when you sort of started the question, income inequality hurts everyone, right? Like, I think that point is true. You talk about it breeding resentment, and that's sort of a little bit of a cultural problem. But I think there's also real measurable harm that income inequality does for a lot of people, including the top 1%. Like, there's a lot of reasons when you sort of look at countries that have more income inequality. Public health is worse, mental health is worse. There's sort of a lot of effects of income inequality that are bad for everyone, right? Whether you're rich, or whether you're struggling. So I think there are some really strong policy reasons to want a progressive system and to want to reduce income inequality. And the only way to do that is through a progressive system, right? You could go further back and kind of look at why income inequality is happening in the first place. And I definitely think there's some interest in addressing that, whether it's wealth taxes or sort of capital gains policies or some of those pieces. But we know it's getting worse. We know it causes problems for everyone. And we know the way to address that at the state level is to make our system as progressive as possible.
That brings me to another part of the report that caught my attention. Well, there's some things about the labor market, but also about poverty and the number of households that struggle with poverty, and how, I'm not seeing the page now, I'm sorry I didn't pull that up, but basically, I think the one household that seemed to be doing okay was if it was double income and no children, I think was the one family makeup that was kind of okay. Could you speak to that a little bit?
So this is something that we've been doing for a couple of years now. And I think actually you might be focused on the basic needs page and less on the poverty page, because, and I want to make that distinction. One thing we did in this report this year was kind of divide it into sections where we felt like we were making progress and sections where we felt like they were still pretty big challenges to be addressed. And the basic needs budget is like whether families are meeting their basic needs is one of those things that I would say is still very much a ch in the challenge category. And I just want to acknowledge, so Vermont does this basic needs report every other year. And not every state does this, but it basically tells you what sort of a livable income is for different family types. It doesn't cover all family types, but it covers kind of the most common family types and really looks at what would it take for those families to sort of be self-sufficient, you know, meet all their basic needs, have things covered. What does that look like? And so what we do is we do an analysis of the census microdata to really look at to get the categories of these families and to compare their incomes to what would be the right amount to meet their basic needs. And what we show in this chart, and I think it's page 20, I think.
Yes, that's what it is.
I can put it up if it's useful. Yes, I can. Let me see.
If you don't mind, that would be great.
Let me share this so that people can see what we're talking about, and not, it's no fun when you're describing a picture. So this really gets you, again, this isn't all families, but it gets you to a lot of the more common family types. And what this shows is share of families in those categories that are able to meet their basic needs, meaning that their income is above whatever the basic needs level is for their family type. Again, obviously the income that you need varies by family type, by how many people are there. And this is a report from the Joint Fiscal Office. They also look at how many wage earners there are, because that plays into whether or not you need childcare and sort of the wage that each person has to earn if you're sort of pooling resources. So the thing that's striking about this, right, is that most two adult, two earner households with no dependents are doing okay. There's still about 15% that aren't meeting their basic needs, but they're in better shape. Again, two earner households are doing better sort of across the board. That two earner, even with two children, they're doing, you know, two-thirds of them are meeting their basic needs. Still means a third aren't, right? A third of families in that situation are not meeting their basic needs. But what's really striking, I think, about this is that you look at across the single households, and regardless of children, which I think is really striking, that a single adult, fewer than half of them are able to meet their basic needs based on their income, right? And then certainly if they're single parents or caregivers, right? Whether one child or two children, really struggling, most of them are not able to meet their basic needs. So I don't think anybody is surprised by this, but when you sort of see it starkly like this, right, it's pretty striking. And I do think that the single adult piece might surprise some people, right? That fewer than half, that's pretty significant. And from our perspective, you know, what we've the legislature has done this report for a number of years, but I think what we'd like to see is them sort of take the next step of applying it when they're developing. And I can stop sharing so we can, if we want to go to a different chart, but.
Well, actually, I was going to ask if you would, on that same page, on page 20, there is the blue graph, the number of households by selected family type. I think one reason the single adult stood out so much to me around one, because I also am a single adult household, but when you look at the family types, or the household types in Vermont, I was surprised that the single adult was so high. And I don't know, it just kind of made me wonder about basic needs and how that's all fitting together in the bigger picture of Vermont's economy and how people are able to contribute and operate within it.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think so, those percentages on that chart are the share of the total population. Again, this isn't all the family types in Vermont. So not so this accounts for about 55 or 60% of the total population. You know, there's some families with three kids, or there's other configurations that don't kind of fall into all these categories. But so single adults are 17% of the population, right? So that, and I think, and that also is a growing number, right? So I think that's relevant too. Like, both the two adults, no kids households and the single adults are growing. So, you know, they are, you know, an increasingly sort of relevant part of the population. If they're really struggling to make ends meet, that's going to have an effect, you know, across a lot of policymaking and the question of how Vermonters are doing.
And when we're talking demographics as well, and we're talking workforce, the fact that the households with no children are the ones that are growing. And to be fair, the folks who are single adult or two adults, or the single adult definitely might be someone who's aging, and their spouse has
Doesn't
passed
mean they
away,
never
or
had children, right?
and they never had children. But it just, when we're talking demographics and workforce and how we are an aging state, I also think the households without children are worth taking a look at as well.
No, I think you're right. I think you're identifying right. It's growing both because across the country, people just you're seeing more people wanting to sort of live without roommates or live on their own or whatever. So you're seeing that like show up in the house, the way housing is developed and all that. So it's definitely that's definitely true. But right, these households aren't necessarily households who never had kids. They might have had kids, but their kids are grown. And to your point, we have one of the older populations in the country, and so many of them may have had kids who are grown or, you know, but what you're also seeing is you know, lower birth rates among younger people. So fewer people are having kids too. So that's so it's both growing sort of from both directions, right? Both on the younger end and on the older end. I think that's true. I worry about the aging demographics conversation a little bit because those aren't inevitable, right? Like we are older right now, but there's also, you know, there's also this conversation about what does that mean broadly? We sort of might be the leading edge of this, but it's happening across the country. You know, we certainly have these sort of population bubbles among the boomers and the millennials, and then the rest of the generations are smaller, right? So that's going to have an effect, but it's not all particular to Vermont. And you know, I tend to believe that making Vermont a good place to live will attract people, families of all types.
Yes. One thing that stands out for me when I see the single adult or the two adults, no kids, is I also think of our systems. And this is a little outside the report, but I think it's worth mentioning. So when my grandmother was going through her death process last summer, the family rallied around, and there was also this expectation that she would have family caregivers. Right? There's just this expectation that when someone is sick or they're at the end of their life, that they will be cared for and surrounded by family. And if we're having more single adult households whose either they never had children and their spouse has passed away, or they never got married, or they have family far away from the community, what does that mean for our systems, and what are we putting into place to care for these folks who may not have the assumed built-in caregiving system? That's just something that has been floating around in my head. And what would that mean for those people economically who then have to maybe pay for care or a system that needs to care for them because they may not have the money to care for them themselves? That is just something that has been floating around in my head. I don't know if you have thoughts on that. If you do, I'd love
No,
to hear them.
I appreciate that, and I'm sorry about your grandmother. I,
No,
you know,
thank
I
you.
think we're, you know, I think there is this challenge of caregiving. The elder caregiving piece is a really, I think it's a really big question. I think Vermont, you know, has some better policies in some states about some of these things, but you're identifying a huge problem, which is that a lot of caregiving, both on the both for children and anyone else, dependents in other ways and elders, is a big chunk of the unpaid work that goes on in this state and that and the country for that matter. And that doesn't show up in the economy, but makes a huge difference, right? Like the absence of those family caregivers, who's picking up that slack? I think you're identifying a really critical question. And I do think that is one piece where I think our demographics can change in the sense that more people could come to Vermont, or, you know, we could have more people could have more kids. You know, there's lots of ways that demographic trends can sort of shift, but there's no question that there are a number of older people in Vermont and that there's an immediate question of what's going to happen and do we have the capacity, both sort of financially, physically, you know, sort of all of the above, the infrastructure available to do the caregiving. And I mean, I think the short answer is we don't have a good solution to what that's going to mean. And, you know, I think there's been a lot of focus on childcare over the last few years, appropriately so, big cost, important, you know, not to diminish that in any way. But the elder caregiving question is also a really big challenge that's going to need a lot of attention. And to your point, there are, you know, not everybody has family caregivers available, and there's going to need to be that. And, you know, we know historically those jobs tend not to be well paid. And so similar to the sort of childcare universe of treating care work as not particularly valuable, when in fact it's sort of the cornerstone of our whole economy, right, is a problem. I think that the childcare work is helpful, right? It's analogous in that way. Like we can build on what we're learning and talking about with the childcare conversation and apply it to elder caregiving. But yeah, I think it's fair to say we're probably underprepared. I mean, as a country, not just Vermont, right?
Yeah.
Like, collectively, yeah.
Well, I found it very interesting, and I'm not the first. Many of my female friends have shared this with me, how there's still that assumption that it will also be the women who show up more so. Not that the men in my family didn't show up as well, but when we were speaking with state systems, there was the, well, oh, but she has a daughter, right? Oh, she's fine. She's got a daughter.
I mean, one of the things that was a little bit surprising to me in this report, actually, that we found was this fact that, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, right, there was all this talk of this she session, and that a lot of women were going to be leaving the workforce in some way because the kids, you know, somebody had to take care of the kids. And it didn't show up. You know, it hasn't shown up in the data. Initially, it sort of seemed like there was, you know, sort of the initial data, it seemed like maybe that was what was happening. And then sort of over time, and what we showed in this report, and I can see if I can, that actually women are back pretty much. There were some dips, but pretty much women are back, and men aren't quite back. So
I found that interesting.
And it really skews along age lines too, which was interesting. Like a whole lot of where the workforce isn't back is on the young side, right? Like so the 16 to 24 range, particularly, you see it with men, it was kind of across the board, but then with women, you know, mostly it's back for women, but particularly on the younger side. And we don't know sort of the details of what that is. Is that part-time jobs that, you know, people were doing while in school, or, you know, doing other things, or is that, it's hard to know what's sort of driving that. But there was less of that. I still have a lot of questions because I know for myself, right, that I worked fewer hours because both my kids were home, and it's impossible to do both, right, full time. But, you know, we haven't, they're not asking the right questions, or that's not what happened, or it's not happening to a measurable degree.
Interesting. Thank you, Stephanie. We're going to take a break and hear from some of our underwriters here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station. If you're just joining us, I am your host, Olga Peters, and I'm speaking with Stephanie Yu from the Public Assets Institute, and we're speaking about their annual State of Working Vermont report that looks at the economy and the workforce and sort of how all that is fitting together, for better or for worse.
Right.
For those who are listening and not seeing the video, Stephanie's nodding away. So glad you're here, Stephanie. I need to quickly thank Brattleboro Community Television for taking the video version of our show and sharing it with media centers across New England. And since my lovely regular contributor, Emily Kornheiser, can't be here, falls to me to say, the views and opinions on the Happy Hour belong to the host and the guests, and nobody else, no, whether they are digital or carbon-based, the opinions belong to nobody else but us. So you have all been warned. Stephanie, before the break, we were talking a little bit about workforce, and I know that this is probably a unknown at this point, but two things in the report that I was just like, that's so interesting. And I don't see how they're happening at the same time. One was, while Vermont still has one of the smallest gender-based pay gaps in the country, women did lose a little bit of ground in pay, even though wages seem to be going up across the board. And with men leaving the workforce, it also made me wonder, because I'm interviewing a lot of contractors this week for another article about our traditionally male-dominated fields, and if we're going to see a shift in them, if they can't find the workers they would traditionally hire. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Sure. So to your point, we do have the smallest wage gap in the country. So that was true in 2019. It's still true in the last year we have information for, which was 2022. For both male and female, the wages grew quite a bit. So I think, we are seeing some progress on wages in the sense, particularly on the low wage end, like even with inflation, some real growth in wages. So that's a positive thing. So you see, it's a pretty big, pretty big jump in the wage, but that gap did get a little bigger between men and women. And so I think you're also pointing to this other trend of sort of more men kind of leaving the workforce. So how does that reconcile? And I think that, the answer is we don't know for sure. We haven't looked at sort of every last thing. I do think there's a couple of factors that are sort of playing into this. One, I think people probably remember, or people as old as I am probably remember, that post-Great Recession, right, that it was particularly hard on male employment, right, that a lot of the male-dominated professions were hit particularly hard during the Great Recession because so much of it was housing and construction related, like what you're saying, right? And so there was sort of this decimation of those, and it took men a really long time to recover their employment levels after the Great Recession. It's not the same thing now. Right, we didn't see a similar. It wasn't a housing crisis. It was really across the board. Most sectors, when we kind of look at sector by sector, most sectors are pretty much back to where they were. I will say manufacturing jobs, have not, which do tend to be a male dominated, have not come back entirely. But two of the, areas I think people noted that really kind of took a big hit were like the hospitality industry, so like retail and food services, restaurant. And those industries tend to be pretty evenly divided among men and women. So I don't know. So it doesn't, so that piece doesn't really explain it. So I think, again, good to see wage growth. Not sure why some of those female, why the wage gap would have gotten bigger, other than to say that some of those, that I think you're probably familiar with the great work that the Change the Story reports did. And what they did a great job of showing, I think, is a lot of industries, a lot of professions are dominated by one or the other, right? Like 75% or more are one or the other. There's not very many industries where it's a pretty even split. And so I'm sure that does play a role, but it's not as obvious as it was in the great, kind of the Great Recession period, right? But, as we were talking about before too, there's also caregiving tends to be undervalued. It tends to be a women-dominated profession. I'm sure all of these things are playing a role.
Well, thank you for that. It'll be interesting to see if any more data or information comes to light as we move forward. Let's pivot a little bit to, well, I'll check in first. Anything else on workers or jobs or the workforce that you want to touch on before we?
Well, I will say, I think, a lot of the conversation has sort of been around a worker shortage in Vermont. And I think, Vermont, we did have this chart I'll show that looks at the number of job openings per person looking for work. So that's sort of the formal definition of somebody who's unemployed and counted in labor force, somebody who's trying to be working and isn't looking for work. And Vermont had the highest ratio in the country of sort of double the US average of how many job openings to unemployed person. So it's definitely true that there are a lot more job openings than there are people looking right now. In tighter labor markets, you would see the opposite, right? You would see more people per job, right? There's two people for every opening or something like that. And that's not where we are now. What we don't know, and I think this is important, is what we don't know is sort of the quality of those jobs. Are those particularly low wage jobs? Are those jobs that are more like retail and hospitality that are sort of more public facing that people are worried about? We don't know the quality of those jobs. That those data are never available, which is something we would love to see and have been sort of trying to to get for a long time, and it's just not something that people want to be public about. So I think there is some real sort of substance to this idea that there are not enough workers. But I think the quality of jobs, and the question of wages might go a long way toward answering that. Another thing that we didn't put in the report this year that we typically do is the fact that Vermonters' wages tend to be low. Like the Vermont average compared to the US average tends to skew lower. So when we talk about, and the cost of things tends to be pretty average, again, sort of with the exception of housing prices in northwestern Vermont, right? Like we tend to be pretty average in terms of housing costs and in terms of the cost of living generally. So pretty comparable to the US average, but our wages are low. So the mismatch is on the wage side, not less so on the cost side. So I think it's just worth noting that while we're kind of back in terms of jobs and employment, we still have this greater demand for workers than we're able to meet right now. And it would be good to kind of understand more about why that is.
As I mentioned, I have been interviewing a number of contractors for a different article this week, and I've asked them that question around workforce shortage. A, do you have one? The answer is, oh my gosh, yes. And to the point that they are starting to scale back on some of the jobs they take. And there's some other things in that equation as well, not just workforce. So I say, okay, so is it that you don't have enough people applying for jobs that you have open, or are the people who are applying, do they lack skills and you're not able to train them? Like, what's the meat here? And many of them have said, a lot of the people who are fully trained, they can kind of demand the work and the salary that they want right now because things are so tight. And that a lot of the folks who are still applying, unfortunately, tend to have a lot of barriers. And this is totally what's that word? Anecdotal. Help me.
Anecdotal.
Thank you. This is not a scientific survey, but the barriers tend to be maybe they lack the skill set, but maybe they also lack transportation or childcare, some other things that are getting in between them and the ability to regularly show up on, 5 days a week. So I just found that interesting, and I'll share that with you in case that triggers anything as you go forward.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I definitely, that's part of our question too, is what are the barriers to work? And when we look at labor force participation, we were sort of looking at it by sex a little bit before, but when we look at it overall, one interesting thing is that labor force participation is down among what we call prime age workers, which is 25 to 64, 25 to 55, right? So from 55 and up, a greater share of them are working, and definitely from 65 and up, it's still a small share, but more of them are working. But at prime age, from 25 to 54, slightly lower on the participation. So it's not just that there's a bigger population of older people and a smaller population of prime age workers. It's also that even for among those workers that are here, fewer or those people that are here in that age group, fewer of them are working. So there's something else going on there that's creating barriers to work that I think we need to understand a little better and, try to figure out what we can do about it, sort of what are the right state policies that can help.
I look forward to hearing an update on that if you get more data. So let's pivot a little bit. As you mentioned, the report for this year, 2023, was broken down into sections: workers and jobs, challenges, progress, capacity for investment. We've talked a little bit about workers and challenges. Can we talk a little bit about where Vermont's made some progress?
Absolutely. So, we do put that wage gap in the progress category because we are number one, right? So that's pretty good. But even if we've lost a little ground, we still sort of do the best job. So that's one place. I think I did also mention that, a lot of that pandemic era aid did bring a whole lot of people out of poverty, but it was temporary. But, a couple of ways that Vermont invested, I mentioned the new child tax credit. That's big. That's a big area of progress. And so, that was $25 million going into the pockets of families. And so we're very clear, right, on what what does help bring people out of poverty? Like in this case, it was essentially increased tax credits, cash benefits that really made the difference. So I think it's pretty clear, right, that makes a big difference. Another area of progress, and I think I just mentioned this too, is we did see real wage growth. So after adjusting for inflation, we did still see real wage growth. Now, that's after wages, particularly at the bottom, had been pretty stagnant for a long time. So it's like it's the right direction. We have a long way to go, right? So those are a couple of areas I think that's really significant. We always look at health insurance, but Vermont's again kind of ranked high in terms of who's got coverage. I think one of the challenges there is, so with anything that we're making progress, it's always like, and there's more to do, or and everybody, most people have health insurance, but is it adequate, right? Is the coverage adequate? Just having it might not be enough, so there's always sort of kind of the next layer to look at. But I think there are some really solid progress. I think that the childcare investment, which we didn't really talk too much about in this report, is really significant. Vermont took a big step forward on childcare this last legislative session. And so that makes a big difference for people too.
Well, and also there was I wanted to check with you because I didn't know if this was a great thing or not, even though you put it in the progress. There was a little talk about food aid. And food benefits grew during COVID, then dropped. So would you go into that a little bit of why that looked positive?
So let me show this one. So food benefits were expanded quite a bit, just the dollar amount of them, right? Both the dollar amount and who was eligible. I mean, I think there was a fair amount of money went into paying for what would have been school meals for those kids who weren't in school or who were only in school a couple of days a week during the pandemic, and that was a part of it. But they also just increased the monthly benefit for families who were getting. So you see that sort of lighter orange is kind of the increase. But looking at that, Vermont did actually expand the base monthly benefit in sort of response to the realization that federal increase was going to go away. We did step up and increase that base amount so that it's a permanently higher benefit amount going forward. So even though you do sort of see that temporarily expanded federal aid kind of drop off, you do see that red bit climbing up, and that is driven by this increase in the baseline.
Thank you. So it sounds to me, if I'm hearing you correctly, that families who need supplemental food funding, they actually have more to work with now
Right,
than
exactly.
before the pandemic. Fantastic. Thank you. For folks who are listening to the podcast version, the audio version, I'm going to link in the show notes to this report. And we were just talking about page 18, if you want to refer to it. Let's talk about capacity for investment. And I think this section stood out to me because in the last year's report, or maybe it was 2021, I don't remember exactly, but you really tracked, you being Public Assets Institute, tracked the difference that public investment made in people's lives. So that has just kind of stayed with me. And so that was what was staying with me when I read the section on capacity for investment.
Yeah, I think people are seeing a lot of demand for additional public investment. So again, some of these problems that were sort of temporarily improved by pandemic aid have always been there, are back, some are exacerbated. But then there's also some new stuff, right? I mean, just the response to the pandemic. Like I think the pandemic, I think there's a lot of predictions that there could be more of these, right? It's a combination of a lot of factors why that went into this happening. But I also think the floods of in July 2023 make it very clear that we need to do more on climate change in the state, right? So, our office was affected in Montpelier. I know a lot of people in Montpelier are still, kind of figuring out what the going forward plan or not, right? Or not reopening. So I think there's a lot of additional costs that are driving the demand for public investment. Again, we sort of talked about the housing situation and the fact that when the pandemic aid ended, many people lost housing, and I think there's a broad consensus that that's not acceptable and that we need to do more about that. So I think there's plenty of demand for investment. And what we wanted to show, I think that there's a lot of talk about sort of what makes Vermont affordable and what works for people, and are we a high tax state? Are we not a high tax state? What is this? What does it mean? And we really wanted to kind of break out some of that information and kind of put it in perspective for people. So one of the things I think we talked about a little earlier is this income inequality is increasing, and we can measurably in Vermont, right? A greater share of income is going to the top 1%, really kind of like the top 5, 15%, right? Like, but especially the 1%, it's really exact, really pronounced. But we also wanted to put that in perspective of what that meant, right? I think
Okay.
people can say, okay, like we can see this trend is going in a direction, but when we talk about what that means from a dollars perspective, like how big a difference that is. And let me see if I can pull up. So because I think we were kind of doing some of this math, right? Like, and not all of this is in the report, but we were doing some of the math on thinking about how much the incomes of the top 1% have grown, let's say, in the last 50 years, right? So we were really looking at the fact that they've grown, the gap between the 1% and the bottom 99% has quadrupled in the last 50 years, right? So it used to be a couple hundred thousand dollars, now it's over a million, right? The gap. So the average income. Now again, there's people in that top 1% that have $600,000 and there's people that have $10 million, right? But point being, to kind of look at it on a per capita basis, we're really seeing that gap grow. And if the bottom 99% had grown as fast, right, the average income would be $100,000 more.
Oh, wow.
That's a big difference. So we really wanted to kind of put some of these big numbers in perspective. And part of what we wanted to show here was, so when you look at the AGI of the top 1%, which is about 3,000 filers, give or take, in Vermont, this
Okay.
is based on tax filers. So it could be, which could be a single person or could be a family filing, but $4.6 billion. And just to kind of put that in perspective, that's double what the general fund is, right? Like, it's a lot of money, because I think when you start to talk about these big numbers, it's like, well, they kind of lose their meaning, right? But a small increase on the top 1% yields a lot to invest. And I think that's sort of where we wanted, why we were talking about some of this, why we're talking about improving the regressivity on the tax system, and why we're really saying that there needs to be this increase on the top. Because one, more and more of the money is going there, and two, they're paying less than a smaller share than the middle class, and the scope of the money is such that a small amount goes a long way in terms of public investment. We really wanted to kind of just be clear about that, and also be clear about the fact that, as I said earlier, like Vermont's a relatively good deal from a tax perspective for lower income and middle class compared to other states. So when we talk about like taxes as creating the affordability problem, it just doesn't hold up to the data.
In the introduction to the report, one thing that stood out to me was there was the paragraph that talked about how for about the last 30 years, Vermont's revenue policy has been to manage to the money, and that now that may not work anymore. Would you sh talk to us a little bit about that? I think it ties into what you were just saying about taxes on the top 1%, but I think that would be worth a deep dive because I think I would argue that that managed to the money is older than 30 years in Vermont. Like I think in some ways it's a deep cultural thing that we pride ourselves on at times, but that doesn't mean it's working when it comes to state government. What are your thoughts?
I think there's definitely a cultural, I mean, I grew up in Massachusetts. I think there is a sort of New England fiscal conservatism, like pride yourself on thriftiness, right? Like I do think there is an element of that. There is a cultural element for sure. But what we were pointing to specifically with that number is the fact that back in the 90s, before we had our own tax system, we had a piggyback system on the federal system. So, right, so your tax liability was based on a percentage of whatever your federal tax liability was. So it was 24%, or it was something like that, right? And we used to change that number every year. And this was under Snelling, actually, right?
Okay.
So we used to change that percentage every year. And not only that, but there was actually a period where in recession, what the administration would say is we actually need more services during recessions. So we actually might need to increase the percentage, the rate during a recession because people's incomes are shrinking. So we need to get that money where we can get it, which tended to be, wealthier people, but we were going to increase the percentage so that we could make sure we could maintain those basic services for all the people who were going to need them. People need more services during a recession, not less. not fewer, right? So that's sort of the turning point that we see as like where it really kind of hardened. So you might be right. There might have been this sort of cultural element of like thriftiness for a long time, but there was this willingness to adjust the revenues. The revenues, there was sort of an automatic process to adjust the revenues based on what we were seeing as the demand for services and the demand for public investment. And when we decoupled, it was not something that we said every year, right? So we kind of got away from that automatic thinking about the revenue side of things. And we got to this place where we just take what the revenue is that comes in based on the current law, and we force the budget under that. And there's less of a conversation about do we do something on the revenue side? Do we adjust these rates because we really don't want to cut these services? We don't have that conversation. We just force the budget under. And what's being given up by that, right? Like, what are the things that are either being neglected or actively underfunded? There's a whole list where that's true. I mean, again, some of these things that we've been talking about get compounded by neglect and underfunding over decades, right? So school infrastructure is one of those things. I mean, I know the school budget works a little differently, but there's these pieces that clearly get worse over time because they're underfunded. So I agree with you, and I think that we can point to a specific point in time where it really hardened and say that's why when we think about managed to the money, we really point to this era of just revenue adjustments not being on the table when it was pretty much par for the course before that, right? That it was part of the conversation.
Interesting. I did not know that about Vermont's history. Thank you, Stephanie. We talked a lot about Vermont's tax structure being progressive, but I'm curious, based on what you just said of how we used to couple to the federal tax system, is that a better way to go, or what were the drawbacks to doing that?
Right. So I think part of the reason actually that we decoupled and further, and even in 2018, we disconnected even more from there were still some things that we were tied to, and we disconnected even more, in part because the trend at the federal level has been to cut taxes for the rich, right? Like, that's sort of been the trend.
Good
And
point. Yeah.
we didn't want to tie ourselves to that. So I think that that was part of, the federal system is still a very progressive income tax system. And, so we do kind of, our progressive income tax is modeled on the federal progressive income tax, but the trend at the federal level has been tax breaks for the rich, and so that has not been something we wanted to be tied to. Maybe it's more of a cultural problem, but I think it's less about how we raise the revenue than making sure we have the conversation about the revenue. Making sure that sort of takes the same, sort of that we're weighing the needs against the need to, against whether it's worth it to raise revenue for this purpose.
Gotcha. Thank you. We are out of time. What would you like to leave listeners with before we end?
I appreciate the conversation. We always put a lot of time into this report, and I think we always learn something too. And I think part of what we're really thinking about is, there's a lot to be proud of in this report. I think Vermont has made a lot of good steps, this child tax credit, and really responded to the pandemic with this acknowledgement of wanting to take better care of people, take better care of one another. And I think that that is a good thing. And I think that there are ways to keep that going. And I think that a lot of times they're sort of like, well, if we get the money from the feds, we'll do it. And if we don't, we won't. And I think that what we want to be able to show is that we can do a lot as a state. We can do this stuff as a state. And there's nothing stopping us.
Stephanie Yu from the Public Assets Institute, so glad you are here. Thank you for joining us. If people want to learn more about your work, where can they find it?
Well, we're everywhere we can be. We're publicassets.org. We're using Instagram a lot more these days, and not so much X, I guess, but we're out there for sure.
And as always, you can find the Montpelier Happy Hour on WVEW 107.7 LP Brattleboro, your community radio station, every Friday at 2, rebroadcast every Wednesday morning, and wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Hey, take care, everyone. Have a good weekend.